Okay, my question was that yesterday with the verse that Nirvana couldn't be apparently a thing or a non-thing, did his some brief description of why it couldn't be a thing, and that it isn't produced by Hawking's position. Nirvana certainly is more different than any other thing. But they didn't, I don't quite, I'm also, they didn't exactly say why it
could be
a non-thing.
Okay.
Non-thing permanent,
right. Right. Okay. Okay. So in the refutation of saying Nirvana is neither a thing nor a non-thing, okay, then it's not a thing because Nirvana's permanent, and so it's not produced by causes and conditions. But then, isn't Nirvana dependent on your practice? Doesn't your practice produce Nirvana? So then isn't Nirvana caused? Isn't it a result of your practice? So then isn't it a produced phenomena? Why isn't it a produced phenomena?
It's like the having softness of people.
But isn't that having stopness produced?
Not in the same way that a seed sprouts, only a name.
What do you mean, only a name?
Well, like a seed produces a sprout, for instance, like called Alex. But you know, having a seedness of the equation, that's just the basis of the label Nirvana. But it's not like Nirvana was produced from the seed of the equation.
Yeah.
If it were produced from the teaching of affliction, then it would be a cause phenomenon and it would be impermanent.
Okay. So then the question comes, well then, so it's not a thing, but isn't it a non-thing? Because a non-thing is a permanent phenomenon, Nirvana is a permanent phenomenon. So isn't it a non-thing? What they often do when they write these texts is they don't put in the word inherently existent, but it's to be understood. So Nirvana is not an inherently existent thing, and it's not an inherently existent non-thing either. Okay? So what they're negating is it being an inherently existent non-thing. Okay? Why isn't it inherently existent? Because Nirvana exists by being merely labeled. Okay, something that's inherently existent doesn't depend on any other factors. Okay, it's independent of any other factors, so it's Nirvana, you know, completely by itself, unrelated to anything else. And as Rinpoche was describing later on in the talk yesterday, you know, Nirvana is defined in relationship to samsara. If you can't define samsara, you can't define Nirvana. Okay, it's like the big and the tall and the short and the, you know, these things. They're defined in relationship to each other. Yeah? And then also, Nirvana exists by being merely labeled independent upon, yeah, the cessation of the afflictions and the inability of that karma to produce rebirth. Okay? In other words, the basis of the label of Nirvana is not the same as the labeled object, Nirvana. Okay? Or the basis of designation isn't the same as the designated object. They depend on each other, but they're not the same. Okay, Natalie? And the designated object aren't the same. For example, you know, we have the recorder here. The recorder is the designated object. The basis of the designation are all the different parts. Okay, now are the parts the same as the recorder? They're not, are they? Even the collection of the parts isn't the same as the recorder. Okay? Yeah? And so that's the same with the self, okay? We have the five psychophysical aggregates. So those are aggregates. One is material for mental. But none of them are the self. So the self is the designated object. The aggregates are the basis of designation. So they depend on each other. You can't have a designated object without a basis of designation and vice versa. So the aggregates and the person are not the same thing. The person depends on the aggregates, but the person is not any one of the aggregates, and it's not the collection of aggregates. Okay? Got it? Yeah. Yeah. The designated object is, all these things are designated objects. But they're designated on the basis of something. There's causes and conditions, there's parts, there's, comparison with something else. So there's some basis of designation. But the two things aren't the same. If they were inherently existent, then they would be exactly the same. Okay? And see, this is our problem, is we confuse the designated object with the basis of designation, and we think that they're exactly the same. Okay? Where do we start? We'll start here and go this way. Okay. The parts of nirvana, the having, the cessation of ignorance is one part, the cessation of attachment is another part, the cessation of anger is another part. Okay? Yeah.
And is function part of the basis of designation?
What do you mean, is function?
I call this a mug because it holds my teeth.
Yeah. Right, okay. So, we have the parts, form a certain thing that does a certain function. And then on the basis of that, we give it a label. Okay? And we're the ones that correlate the label with the function. Because when we say cup, we think of something that holds tea. But that correlation between the sound cup, the label cup, and the ability to hold tea is something that our mind has put together. Because people in another culture call it tas. They don't call it cup. Okay?
You went to something also about with it being empty, right? Space.
Yeah.
But we know space isn't empty.
Okay, there's different kinds of space, in Buddhism. There's a permanent space and there's an impermanent space. So the permanent space is the lack of obstructability and tangibility, okay, and that doesn't change. Mm-hmm. And then the impermanent space is the distance between here and there and, which is, of course, filled with air and other stuff like that. Right, right. So there's different... No, they have different definitions. The permanent space is the lack of tangibility and obstructability. The impermanent space is just what we see, when we look out. Okay, so they're different. They have different definitions. Okay. Yeah.
But nirvana is a permanent phenomenon.
Yeah.
What's the difference between... why is it permanent
why is it permanent?
Yeah.
Because it doesn't change. Yeah. Okay. So once you have ceased anger, completely from the root, that having ceasedness of the anger doesn't change. It's the complete absence of that anger. Okay? and there's no cause for anger to come back again.
So it came into non, or the other thing ceased to be, and therefore then.
Yes. Right.
Okay. So you're saying the cause has ceased?
I'm saying the anger ceased, or the ignorance ceased, or whatever it was, and that having ceaseness, that mm-hmm. absence mm-hmm. of that phenomena, is labeled nirvana. Okay? So nirvana is, you see, they talk about positive or affirmative phenomena and negative phenomena, or negations. Okay, affirmations and negations. An affirmative phenomena is something, you know, there's the table, there's the cup, there's the water, okay? A negation is an absence of something. Okay, it's a totally different way of thinking. It's a lack, it's an absence, it's a not being there of something. Okay, so nothing positive is being asserted, just the absence of something else. So that's why it's called a negation, and negations are permanent. Okay?
So when we hear a sound, the basis, and then when what we impute, so the basis is the ear consciousness hearing, the auditory mechanism.
The basis are the sound waves.
Okay. Okay. And then when we label it something, then that's when we make it solid and out there.
Well, there's nothing wrong with labeling per se. You know, I mean, there's sound waves and they do one thing, and there's light waves and they do other things. And calling something red and calling something a sound, you know, that's helpful in our conventional world. But what happens after that is that we think that these things have their own nature and that the designated object is the basis of designation, so that everything has its own inherent nature. That's where we get screwed up.
So if we want to work with that to back up and get back to what it really is, then doesn't it help to kind of loosen up the label?
Yeah, it does help. So that's why when we do the thought training practices, okay, let's say when you're angry, then we're just imputing negativity on the other person. When we say, well, the situation's a result of my karma, we're interpreting the thing in a different way, so we have a different label on the situation. Instead of labeling it, this person is out to get me, we're labeling it, this event is the result of my own action. And in dependence upon the label we give to it, we experience it differently. Okay? So that's an initial way for us to start seeing how our conceptual mind creates our reality, and how, especially when we grasp these concepts to exist independently, instead of realizing that we're creating the concepts. Okay? So it's kind of like, you know, the Escher drawings, how you can look at something and you see it one way, it looks this way, you see another way, you look that. Or it's like the linoleum floor when you were a kid with the dots on it. Do you remember? You could look at it, you can see faces on the floor, you can see cards, you can see monsters. You know, your mind plays, okay? So all of that is our mind taking different things and putting them together and making them into something by virtue of putting a, you know, imputing a concept on them, creating a concept about them. Okay? And yet all those things, all those dots in the linoleum, you know, they aren't inherently a person or a car or a monster. It's our mind that's putting them together in that way. So similarly, when we get angry, it's our mind putting together sound, waves, color, shape, all these other things, and then, you know, just imputing this whole big to-do about it. Yeah? So just beginning to understand how our mind create situations by the way we conceptualize them, that is a very good way to, I think, start to understand emptiness. It's a very gross way. We're not challenging the inherent existence of any of the objects in the situation, but we're just beginning to see how our mind creates things by the way we conceptualize and label them. Yeah. So it's the whole thing that we have in Dharma practice between labeling something a problem and labeling it an opportunity. And the same situation, if you label it a problem, you react one way. If you label it an opportunity, you react another way.
Pro-blame.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, all these things that the mind creates. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
What are the criteria for a valid mind and a mistaken mind?
Okay. Criteria for a valid mind and a mistaken mind. A valid cognizer has three criteria. One is that it's something that's renowned in the world. In other words, there's other people who have the same kind of labels. It doesn't mean everybody has to have that label, but some, you know, some other, somebody else besides you. Okay? And then the second is that it's not contradicted by another valid cognizer. Okay? So, you know, there could be two people who say the emperor has these beautiful clothes on, and and we could say, oh, well, you know, somebody else besides me believes it, but it's contradicted by other people's valid cognizer that sees the emperor doesn't have any clothes. Okay? So, you know, it can't be contradicted by another valid cognizer. And then third is that it's not contradicted by a valid cognizer of the ultimate, meaning a wisdom realizing emptiness. In other words, when we apprehend truly existent objects, the mind apprehending a truly existent object is an erroneous mind. It's a mistaken mind because a truly existent object doesn't exist. Okay? But many of our normal perceptions, our everyday perceptions, we aren't grasping at either true existence or non-true existence. We're just kind of in this fuzzy kind of middle thing where the object is appearing truly existent, but we're not grasping it that way. And so then, as Rinpoche was saying yesterday, so we say I walk and I talk and here's the cup and things like that. Okay? So those are conventional valid cognizers, even though they're mistaken minds. Mm-hmm. And they're mistaken because the appearing object is a truly existent whatever. Mm-hmm. Okay? So the appearance of true existence, that makes it a mistaken mind. If we don't grasp that the true existence, then it's a valid cognizer. As long as it's not contradicted, as long as it's renowned in the world and not contradicted by another valid cognizer. But sometimes we grasp that object as truly existent. Okay? And that mind that grasps it true existence is erroneous, is completely false, because the apprehended object, the truly existent whatever, doesn't exist. Okay? But again, we're so we're so used to just kind of how we perceive things and taking them for granted that we don't differentiate between when we're just perceiving, you know, kind of the thing in a conventionally valid way and when we're perceiving an inherently existent thing. Yeah? Because we're really unaware of our experience. So that's why, you know, the first thing in the emptiness meditation is to, you know, get an idea or a sense about what the object of negation is. So that's why they say, okay, when you're angry, how does the I appear to you? And how is that different than when you're just calm? Yeah? So how is the feeling or the appearance of I different from the feeling or appearance of I? Okay? And how is, you know, how are you apprehending something when you say that's a glass case versus that's a glass case? Beautiful glass case. I want this. It's mine. You know? Okay? So how are the things appearing differently to you? Okay? So this is hard to recognize. It's hard to see. Because we just go through the day reacting every old way, and we, you know, and we never even think, oh, my mind's not perceiving reality. Yeah? So even when we're angry, which, you know, anger like follows down the line from ignorance, or even when we have a lot of attachment, which is, you know, many mind moments down from the initial ignorance, we still not even, don't even doubt that cognition. And we're still completely convinced that it's true. When we're attached to something, that thing really is that beautiful. Definitely. And I really need it, otherwise I'm going to, you know, curl up and die in the second. Hey, yeah?
So the feeling pattern is a helpful tool in being able to start to discern where our minds are.
Okay. The feeling aggregate, you know, to help discern where our minds are. The word feeling is used in Buddhism in a particular way, and in English it's used in a whole variety of ways. In Buddhism, feeling refers to pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, and neutral feeling. Okay, when I say get the feeling of what how the eye appears, I'm not referring to the feeling aggregate. I'm using the English word feeling in all of its different connotations.
But our version of feeling would be a helpful tool to use in just figuring out where we are and why we're starting to identify where we are and how we're feeling and how we're perceiving it.
Yeah.
Emotional life.
Yeah, well, it's not just the emotional life, it's the thought life. Because remember, emotions are thoughts. They aren't different. Yeah, we usually think they're really different, but they're not. Okay. Yeah?
Two things when you're talking about valid mind and mistaken mind, the third characteristic of valid mind.
That it's not contradicted by a cognizer of ultimate truth.
Okay. And then were there opposing characteristics of the mistaken mind, or were there characteristics of the mistaken mind other than grasping?
Well, the mistaken mind is just a mistaken mind isn't necessarily, from the Prasangika viewpoint, it's not necessarily grasping at true existence. It could be apprehending true existence. Okay, in other words, maybe it's better to say true existence could be appearing to that mind, but it's not apprehending it at that time. That's a better way to say it. Okay, Bart?
Yeah, I'm trying to understand all the different ways ignorance can change.
Yeah.
So I'm looking back at my list of the six root afflictions, and there's the ignorance that isn't the root of psychic existence on that list, and then there's the view of the transitory collection, which is the first of the afflictive views that is the. So what is that ignorance that
okay.
is not the root of psychic existence?
Okay. Okay, so how is the word ignorance used? Ignorance, there's many, many different kinds of ignorance. Okay? Many ignorances. So, you know, sometimes they divide it into two general categories. The ignorance of ultimate truth, the ignorance of conventional truth. And the ignorance of conventional truth principally refers to the ignorance of cause and effect. So that ignorance of cause and effect is not the root of cyclic existence. Okay? the root of cyclic existence is the ignorance of ultimate truth as it's defined by the Prasangika. Okay? So when you have that ignorance of ultimate truth, then you're grasping at things as truly existent. And then you have, then, you know, the ignorance of karma and its effects coming up. And we look at something and we say, well, there's nothing wrong with acting that way, you know. And so we even think that there's no ethical dimension to our actions, or maybe there's an ethical dimension, but it's not going to ripen. There's no result of the ethical dimension, or something like that. Yeah. So that kind of ignorance is not the root of cyclic existence.
So in that list of the six afflictions,
yeah,
what that means.
In the list of the six afflictions, they pile all the different kinds of ignorance all together.
I see.
You know? It's just ignorance, all the different kinds of ignorance. Yeah. Now, according to the Prasangika, when you have, you know, you have the five, and then you have the sixth one, which is afflicted views, all the afflicted views are actually forms of ignorance. In particular, the view of the perishing aggregates, jinta, that one is a type of self-grasping ignorance. Specifically, it's a type of self-grasping ignorance of the person.
And so in all of this, that's the one that we're talking about here, when we're looking at self-grasping of a person.
Oh, when we're when we're looking at the first link of the 12 links, we're looking at view of the perishing aggregates.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. But the ignorance of that's the first link is not the same as the ignorance that's the root of cyclic existence. Because the ignorance of the first link refers specifically to that moment of the view of the perishing aggregates, which is of yourself, not of other people, but of yourself, seeing yourself as inherently existent, that is powerful enough to create a karma. Okay? Because the 12 links talk about how we get born in samsara. So that ignorance has to be powerful enough to set off the second link.
I understand that. I don't understand where it fits to the picture of all the different things.
It's because it's the primary one. Whenever we create karma, the primary kind of ignorance we have is I, me, this is bothering me, I want that. You know, the inherent existence of the grapefruit isn't our biggest problem. Yeah, perceiving the grapefruit as inherently existent is not the root of our, you know, is not the thing that causes us to create karma that propels rebirth. So that's why they're not listing the grasping at the self of phenomena as the first link.
Okay. So self-grasping of phenomena is chiefly about the aggregate, but that's not the problem. The problem is when the self-grasping of person is on the basis of that self-grasping of phenomena, and that's what that is. The
right. So the self-grasping of phenomena is a problem.
Yeah.
You know, because as he was explaining the first day, unless we're able to refute the referent object of that one, we can't refute the referent object of the self persons. Okay? Yeah. But usually they say when you do the meditation, you start refuting your own self and then go backwards, because they say it's easier to refute, to identify, you know, your own self and refute that one. It's more powerful to do that. Okay. So the self-grasping of persons arises in dependence on the self-grasping of phenomena. Because we grasp the aggregates as truly existent, then the person is truly existent. But it's that one grasping me in particular as truly existent that becomes a problem. Me grasping you as truly existent, that could be a problem, but it's not, It doesn't, it's not a problem unless I'm also grasping me as truly existent. Okay? Yeah?
So, go back to the Kali Kaga.
Uh-huh.
What is the purpose or value of even labeling that? Because it sounds like the criteria are unfulfillable.
Oh.
If you have to have, it has to be conditionally acceptable by other people for it to be a valid cognizer. But then if there's any other valid cognizer, so any other group of people that believe something different, then both are wrong.
Mm, okay. So you're saying, you know, that... that, you know, what's the use of saying valid cognizers? Because if I believe one thing and somebody else believes another thing, or my group believes one thing and somebody else believes another thing, then they're refuting my group. Well, not necessarily so. Because look at the situation, okay? We in Buddhism, we say there's no God, okay? Now, there's a lot of people on this planet that believe that there's a creator God. Does that mean it, that there's a creator God that exists just because people label it and conceive it?
No.
No. Okay. So just because there's a whole lot of people who say even that they've had an experience of God, does that mean that God actually exists? No. Okay. So, you know, just because there's different groups that believe different things doesn't mean that all of those various beliefs are valid cognizers.
But it wasn't a criteria that they be correct in order to... It's just the criteria was that other people agree with it.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean everybody agrees with it. It just means that it's known in the world. Okay? Well, if I look at this and call it a cup, okay, that's a valid cognizer because we all kind of look at this and call it a cup. I mean, that's one reason. That first criteria, that it's renowned in the world, that means that there's other people here who see that as a cup. But that alone isn't sufficient to make my mind a valid cognizer of a cup. Because let's say we all called it a grapefruit. And we thought of it as a grapefruit. And we were going to peel it and, you know, eat the different sections. Then... just because we all thought that doesn't make it a grapefruit.
But what we're still about our cognizer.
No.
But that's
no.
In the list of things
you have to have all three.
Well,
all three. So, okay. Well, look, the emperor having clothes, okay, is a real good example. Okay? So we look at the emperor, and we say the emperor has clothes. Those beautiful clothes he's wearing, you know, there's a whole group of people and we're saying, oh, what beautiful brocade and silks the emperor's wearing, okay? Then, and we're completely convinced that the emperor is wearing clothes. Now, that of the three criteria, you know, that kind of meets the first one, that, you know, it's renowned in the world. But the second one is, the second criteria is that it's not contradicted by any other valid cognizers. Now, there's other people who look and say, you guys, the emperor is stark raving naked. What are you talking about? You know, and they can prove that because they can go there and, you know, there's no clothes to pull off the emperor because he isn't wearing anything. Okay? So our perception is contradicted by their valid cognizer of the emperor not wearing any clothes. So our perception of the emperor wearing clothes is wrong. It's not a valid cognizer. Okay? Because it's contradicted by people who see it correctly. If you walk down the road and you see the thing in Michael and Sally's garden and you say there's a person... wow, that person's standing there every day, 24 hours in the garden, to, you know, so that the crows don't eat the garden. And the person's there even in the winter when there aren't any crows, you know. Fuck this poor guy, you know, he's frozen, he's tired, he never gets to sit down, you know. So we might think that there's a real person there, but that doesn't mean there is one. Our mind is mistaken, even if there's a few of us who think that that's a person.
I still don't understand how that makes it not a valid cognizer. Well, how? Why wouldn't they both be not valid cognizers? Because it doesn't say in the list of valid cognizers that what we perceive has to be correct. It just says that others have to agree with it, and it doesn't contradict.
Yeah, but that's how a valid cognizer is a reliable cognizer. In other words, you can rely on it to perform certain functions. Yeah. If I call my mind perceiving a person in Sally's garden a valid cognizer, and I invited that person to dinner, yeah, I'm gonna have pretty hurt feelings because he's not even gonna talk to me when I invite him. Okay? So he doesn't function as a person. Yeah? So my mind apprehending a person there is incorrect. There's no person there. That's not a valid cognizer. I can't perform a conventional action of relying on, you know, of inviting a person to dinner on the basis of talking to that scarecrow. Okay, so that's why it's not a valid cognizer.
What happens when you have an object that could be used in two different ways and both people are seeing it as a different object, like the cup and the hat? Like you have one group that says the hat and the other person says the cup.
Well yeah, but this can be used as a hat? You know, I would shape it a little bit differently and make it out of a different material. You know, most. Well, that. And use your new hats to protect you from the sun.
Well, I have to get a broader brim hat.
No. Okay, so if you make it different, if you have something that's, let's say, made out of some kind, let's say plexiglass, and it's in the shape of a sun hat, and you can use it as a sun hat, but you can also pour water in it and drink from it, then you could call it both a hat and a cup. But I don't think this one you could call a hat.
I think it's pretty
nice. Okay, well, you wear it when you're outside with a big yellow ribbon. I think it's good. So hold it on.
And it works for both things, then by this list, wouldn't that make us both not valid cognizers?
No, if it could be used for both purposes, you know, if it actually can be used to protect you from sun and it can be used to hold your tea, then there's no problem in calling it both a hat and a cup. But if it can only do one of those functions and not the other, then you can't give it the label that pertains to that other function.
Yeah.
Okay.
So there were three?
Yeah. So it's conventionally renowned, it's not contradicted by another valid cognizer, and it's not contradicted by a valid cognizer of ultimate reality. Yeah?
My question was about when Nagarjuna is talking to the lower school, saying, no, you don't need to be afraid of that being.
Mm-hmm.
Because in your own system, you have your own sort of, you know, problems, which you should actually be afraid of. I was wondering, it sounded like, it sounded, I wasn't exactly sure, but it sounded like some of the lower schools, when they talked about nirvana without remainder,
uh-huh.
it's actually a wholesale cutting of the continuum of the aggregate, such that it's non-existent.
Hmm.
I thought that seemed so strange. It's like you attain nirvana, but then you stop existing. You don't even get to enjoy it.
Yes. this is right.
You get out okay. of
pain. Now, okay. This is how the this is why I have some doubt about exactly what these people in India believed. Okay. And also there's you can really see here that because the Tibetans tend to think that the modern-day Theravada school, that they're all Vaibhasikas or Satantrikas, and that's not necessarily the case. Okay, now it seems that some people believed, on the basis of the Pali Canon, that when the Buddha or anybody attained arhatship, okay, that there's nirvana with remainder and nirvana without remainder. The nirvana with remainder is in that lifetime when you attain arhatship, while you're still alive, your mind is free of afflictions. Your mind is no longer creating the karma that causes rebirth. But you still have the afflicted aggregates that you were born with. So that's nirvana with the remainder of the afflicted aggregates that you were born with. When you die from that life, you shed these afflicted aggregates. And so some people say, therefore, there's no continuity of consciousness, you know, at parinirvana, that the consciousness just ceases, and that's nirvana without remainder. Now, of course, the upper schools refute that, and then they say, well, whose nirvana is it if there's no aggregates, then there's no person, so then you can't speak of a person having attained nirvana, you know, or a person who has nirvana. Or if when you say there's a person, then there has to be the afflicted aggregates, but then they haven't attained full nirvana because, you know, they haven't left those aggregates yet, you know, they still have the remainder. So, you know, that's the way of refuting that. Okay, because the upper schools say that the consciousness continues. Now, in my research, which is still incomplete, in the Pali Canon, the Buddha, and from talking to my friends in the Theravada, it seems like the Buddha did not specify, you know, that he did not literally say all the five aggregates cease at the time of parinirvana. He didn't say that. He just says, you know, what is to be abandoned has been abandoned, and there's no more birth, and, you know, there's no more, I don't know if he says there's no more mind or anything like that, but it could be argued that he's just saying there's no more afflicted mind at the time of parinirvana, which is completely true. That doesn't necessarily mean that the continuity of all consciousness is cut off. Now, some people in the Theravada school say that, but not everybody. There's some people in Theravada who assert that there is, you know, a pure mind that continues after the arhat leaves their body.
But there are things in the Pali Canon that I've read, if I remember this correctly, people actually question the Buddha and say, like, does the arhat exist after death?
Right.
And the Buddha says, it's not quite like that. And they say, well, does he exist after death? And he says, it's not quite like that either.
Yeah. Okay, so there's this thing is where they say, does the Tathagata exist after death, not exist, both or neither? You know, it's the famous things. They asked this at the time of the Buddha. The way the Mahayana, the way the Prasangika interprets that, well, put it this way, forget Prasangika for the moment. The reason why the Buddha didn't answer that question and state any of those four alternatives was because the way the person was asking it, their mind was clouded with misconceptions, and however the Buddha could have responded, the person would have not understood it correctly. Okay, so he just didn't answer. It's like if you say to me, is this purple or is it brown? Okay, well, I'm not going to answer that question because the alternatives that you're giving me, you know, is it purple, is it brown, is it both, or is it neither? Yeah. Yeah. Then I'm not going to be able to answer that, because however I answer it, your way of thinking is not going to apprehend my answer correctly. Okay? So from a Prasangika viewpoint, they would say, well, that person is saying, you know, is there an inherently existent tathagata after they die? Or is there not an inherently, you know, or is there or is the person totally non-existent after they die? Yeah, is there no tathagata whatsoever? Or is the person, or is the tathagata both existent and totally non-existent, both inherently existent and totally non-existent? Or the neither in this case refers to some other inherently existent alternative. Okay? So the whole way the person was thinking was in terms of inherent existence. So the Buddha couldn't answer that question. Yeah? And so that's why he left it unanswered. Yeah, and in the same way, you know, when the Buddha was questioned about, is there a beginning of the universe? Yeah, well, it's the same way. The person was thinking in terms of an inherently existent beginning and total non-existence. So however he responded, the person would have misunderstood, so he didn't respond. Okay. Yeah.
So when it's said that there is no more birth.
Uh-huh.
My understanding of bodhisattvas or of fully enlightened beings is that they can choose to come into a body, but there isn't the, like, compelled birth that we all experience.
Uh-huh.
Is that...
Yeah. For the high-level bodhisattvas, in other words, the bodhisattvas on the path of seeing who've realized emptiness directly and above, okay, they don't operate within the 12 links. Okay? So they have the ability to control karma. They have the ability to make manifestations. So their appearing in our world is not under the influence of afflictions and karma. They're not within the 12 links.
But they can still choose to come.
Yeah, out of compassion. Yeah. Whereas the rest of us, we're right in the middle of the 12 links, you know? Uh-huh.
So the individual that believe that the actives don't exist in nirvana, do they believe that the Buddha can emanate then?
No. No. Yeah. So those people who say that at the time of parinirvana, the Buddha's aggregates go out of existence, yeah, then they don't talk about the Buddha as being able to emanate many forms. They say the Buddha was an ordinary human being. He had some psychic powers while he was alive, but then once he attained parinirvana, then his aggregates ceased. There's no opportunity to manifest in the world. That's it. Okay. And as Holiness says, you know, if you look at it that way, then it doesn't make much sense to spend so long practicing the bodhisattva path. Because he says, then the Buddha spent three countless great eons to attain full enlightenment, which he did at age 35, and then he passed away at 80 or 81, and so then he had like 45, 46 years to benefit sentient beings, but it took him three countless great eons to get to be a Buddha? That doesn't make any sense. Yeah? Yeah, right. You know, go out of existence, and that's, you know, kaput. Yeah?
For them, you assert that the liberation of an arhat and a Buddha are completely equal in that it's just dissipation of the aggregate.
Yes.
But that's strange, because I think in the Theravada they do say that the topic of liberation is superior.
Yeah. So in the sense of the parinirvana and the extinguishment of the aggregates, that's the same from a Theravada viewpoint in case of an arhat and a Buddha. But you're right. They do say that the Tathagata's enlightenment is superior because the Buddha also created other causes. He developed the infinite love and compassion. He has all the full clairvoyant powers. So he has many other abilities that not all of the arhats have. So it's in that way that the Buddha's enlightenment is superior.
For
the
sword
fight.
Yes.
So the example of this innate eye-grasping mind.
Yeah.
The innate one. Which one's the one we just kind of walk around with and we're not grabbing?
That, the innate one?
Yeah.
Yeah. Has been there since beginningless time. And as he explained yesterday, it's there either as a seed or in a manifest form.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So when we kind of up the ante and start grabbing, you know, if
that's
a cup, I don't care about Judith's cup, but I care about my cup.
Right.
The karma, it seems to me that when I get here on my cup, then all the afflictions can rise, and they do, and then I can maybe, you know, Diane reaches for it and I push her away or whatever. But I don't really, you know, it's like, okay, I just watch.
Yeah.
What kind of karma am I doing there where I'm just watching? It doesn't seem like it doesn't seem like I'm doing anything ostensibly, you know, negative.
Right, you aren't. I mean, if you're watching her take, you know, somebody else's cup, you're not doing anything negative unless you're sitting there, go for it, Diane. Yeah, you're still ignorant, but you're not really, you know, there's ignorance there, but ignorance itself is not a negative mental factor.
Oh.
Yeah, and ignorance itself, negative in the sense of non-virtuous, you know?
Non-virtuous, that is my question.
Yeah, so ignorance is a neutral mental factor. It's not necessarily non-virtuous. Because we might also have ignorance when we make offerings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there might be some grasping at the Buddha is truly existent, and yet we're still creating virtue when we make offerings to the Buddha. Yeah, but you know, the danger is when the innate ignorance is manifest, it's very easy to go towards the non-virtuous side.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when we're making offerings, probably it's just, you know, that third kind of cognizer. You're just seeing the conventional thing, not as one way or as the other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then on that basis, you're making offerings. That's probably the way we usually make offerings, hopefully. Yeah, because the danger is if we start seeing the Buddha as truly existent, then it's very easy for then offering to slip into some kind of attachment or something. Mm-hmm.
How many primary minds move from rebirth to rebirth? And maybe I'm misunderstanding, but is the innate eye grasping that's with us since the beginning of time, is that a primary mind?
Oh, no. The primary minds are, you know, the visual consciousness, auditory, olfactory, gustatory, tactile, and mental. And so the primary consciousnesses just perceive the general presence of the object. The ignorance is a mental factor. Okay? So it arises, it becomes manifest only sometimes. The seeds of all the mental factors can go from one birth to the next if we haven't eradicated those mental factors and their seeds. Okay, Trace, this will be the last question.
How does karma relate to dependent arising? Is one a subcategory of another?
How does karma relate to dependent arising? Karma is a dependent arising. Okay? So karma arises independence upon its causes, the afflictions, the ignorance. Okay? So it arises independence upon those, and then the karma itself leaves a seed, and it leaves a having ceasedness, disintegratedness, and then those things produce results of the karma, so the karma also acts as a cause of other things. Okay, so it's an effect of the afflictions, and it's a cause of different experiences we have. Okay, so in that way it's a dependent arising. And I think that's very helpful to think about. And when he was talking yesterday about how when we do purification, seeing the negative actions as dependent arising and therefore as emptiness, as empty, that helps us purify it. Because you can see sometimes we do a negative action and then we grasp that our negative action is truly existent, and on that basis we feel guilty and we beat ourselves up. But when you see that the negative action, you know, it does not exist in and of itself. It exists only in relationship to a person, in relationship to an object, in relationship to effect, that it's something that's caused, that didn't just exist in and of itself, then your whole view towards the negative action changes. It becomes much, much softer. It becomes easier to forgive yourself. Okay, and easier to purify. Okay.